Welcome to Crash Concepts, where the economy, energy, and the environment are explored. Up next, fresh ideas and insights into the factors that are driving the world and shaping your future. Presenting information you can't afford to live without, here's Chris Martinson.
Welcome to this Peak Prosperity Podcast. I am your host, Chris Martinson, and today we welcome back Francis Koster. Francis runs the website theoptimisticfuturist.com, and he's one of my favorite people to speak with because he dedicates himself to answering a very difficult but very important need. What are the new business models we need to invest in today to meet the coming future defined by the crash course with some degree of grace? Francis scours the world for sustainable, reproducible business models that deliver positive ROI to all stakeholders, and most of these are deployed at the local level. His website presents well-documented case studies of these successes so that interested investors can learn how to reproduce them in their own communities. I love how this builds resilience and gives a financial alternative to sending capital off to Wall Street. And most importantly, his case studies prove the point that to make a better world today, we do not have to wait for some new technology to be invented tomorrow. Everything we already need in terms of technology, processes, and understandings, well, we already have them. We just need to use it. Francis, it's a real pleasure to have you back as our guest.
I'm delighted for the invitation. Thank you very much.
Well, Francis, it's been a while since you've been on the program, so can you give our listeners a quick summary of your mission and how it is you came to be doing this work?
I did my doctorate at the University of Massachusetts a long time ago, and the central issue that I focused on was why leaders don't listen to warnings. And I did my dissertation on that topic, and I examined a whole set of valid warnings that had been issued and disregarded at great human catastrophe. I went through, I worked, as you know, in the university setting. Then I set up and ran the renewable energy programs at the University of Massachusetts, was hired to run them at the Tennessee Valley Authority for a while, and then I switched when the energy prices dropped so much that their interest in renewables went away. I switched into healthcare and finished a substantial portion of my career there. So post-retirement from healthcare, I returned to my first love, which is why leaders don't listen to warnings, and I focus specifically on the basic life support systems of air, water, food, and fuel, and the public health consequences of how we satisfy them. And any time you start to alter behavior, you run into the financial metric system. Is it a good investment? Is it a good investment for who? Who gets to capture the investment? Who's required to make it, and so forth. So our worlds then begin to overlap. And so I've spent a lot of time thinking about how to make win-wins in that environment.
All right. Well, listen, so building off the idea of why leaders don't listen to warnings, here's a quote from you that's taken out of your new book. The quote reads, "Telling leaders that the sky is going to fall only makes them feel impotent, discouraged, and resistant unless you can also hand them an umbrella and a map to safe shelter. If a problem is pointed out without furnishing a solution, the recipient of the warning reacts psychologically by blocking that warning." Now, I love the way you've learn that the best way to motivate people is to present that open door, not just the warning. A lot of those listening to this conversation right now have tried to influence loved ones or community leaders, sometimes with little success. So building on your PhD and then coming back to it, what learnings can you share that can help people be more successful in their effort to not just have people listen to warnings, but to react in a positive way?
Well, let's imagine a crowded banquet hall or someplace. The lights are on. It's multi-generational. There's young moms with toddlers crawling around. The family is gathered. Maybe mom and dad are trying to control the kids. Grandma and grandpa are sitting there beaming with pride. The civic leaders are up there on the dais. And suddenly somebody comes into the room and says, "I smell smoke in the hallway." Who do you think is going to respond the quickest?
Well, if I was in the room, that'd be me.
That would be you, and that explains why you've got the particular life mission you've got. But the answer is, empirically demonstrated, is the young mothers. The young mothers would act out of a sense of responsibility for the children.
Yeah.
And they would begin to look around for exits. They'd begin to gather up the toys. They wouldn't necessarily bolt for the doors yet, but they would heed the warning and begin their preparation. Then they'd glance across the table at their husband and say, hey, you know, unpack the stroller. Let's get ready here. But the immediate warning recipient would be that person who is responsible for helpless or otherwise not fully self-sufficient individuals. The ones who would be least likely to respond are the ones up on the dais. And there's two reasons for this. One is they probably have a private exit. They'd go back through the stage or something like that where they had cocktails beforehand. Secondly, they're relatively psychologically bulletproof. They have assets, by and large, more than the audience. They probably have education. They certainly have social status. And they don't have young kids anymore. Those kids are gone. So our leadership class is essentially feel psychologically a little more bulletproof than the dependents that they are supposed to be taken care of. So what we would have would be an aroused young population and a slow leadership group. And the leadership group, if it chose to start to lead, would constantly be scanning the crowd to gain their approval and say, is it okay if I, you know, approach the mic and begin to offer cautionary warnings? Wait a minute, maybe the guy sitting next to me on the dais, he wants to do it. I think I'll step back. There'd be some posturing, some checking, some sniffing. And if a second person entered the hall and said, the smoke is, you know, I something's not right out there, you'd begin to see the moms gathering the kids up and heading for the doors, while the leadership class would be tilting their heads towards each other and trying to figure out what to do. So the short answer to your question is people who heed warnings the most are those who have a palpable sense of responsibility for others and who have the most perceived to lose.
Well, let's talk about this potentially aroused young population, as you put it. The story you're painting is that there's some sort of a sclerosis that sets in when people have been in a position of power for a while, but it's really the younger, self-motivated individuals who might be leading the change. So thinking about your work where you go out and you're scouring the world for these really clear, passionate sort of responses to the challenges we face, do you find that there are disproportionately young people starting to gravitate into the solution space versus versus the more entrenched players? Or how's that shaking out?
Well, the responders, if you would, tend to fit a certain psychological profile. But the primary piece is this sense of responsibility for others. To tell a story you may have heard me say before, for many, many years, there was a campaign to have the United States buckle up when you drove your car. Mm-hmm. There were all kinds of advertisements about buckle up for your own safety. And nobody did it. The results were less than 12% of all drivers buckled up. So they changed the messaging, and the messaging became, if you don't buckle up, your kids won't either. And immediately, the compliance rate went up. People would act out of responsibility for others before they would take care of themselves.
Okay, so let's cast that into current situation where, you know, one of the things I follow very closely is the national budget scene, but this is being played out at the municipal levels as well, where there's clearly a mathematical train wreck coming. The people who are supposed to be in that primary responder role seem to be completely asleep at the switch, and so there's some combination of psychological factors at work there, which wanting to not step too far out of the fold, running out the clock in their current position, whatever those things are. Is that what you're saying is happening here? It's not...
It's a substantial portion of it, because the difference between leadership or power and authority, a cop has power. He wears a blue uniform. He can enforce his will on you by pulling out his tear gas or his gun or whatever. Authority is more like stuff that the pastor has or the bishop has or the college president who's granting the degrees. They wear a robe. You give them the authority to guide your life. And politicians derive their authority from their constituents. If a pastor gets up in front of his congregation and advocates something that the congregation itself doesn't want, he will be out of a job. His entire authority rests on the consent of the governed. And right now we're in a situation where for many, many politicians, they don't have consent of the governed. They've got a badly divided polity out there. And so what I have done in my work is try and figure out what are the win-wins that they can present to their constituency. On the one hand, the Tea Party is going to like this because. On the other hand, the leftists are going to like this because. And come up with win-wins that you can assemble and maintain your authority. And that's what I try and do, is I try and explain to leadership, you can please all sides of the aisle and do social good if you'll just do these three things.
Well, fantastic. And I think part of what you're describing, too, is that there's a sense of institutional or sometimes cultural inertia that keeps us doing things the way we have been doing things. And so that sounds challenging, but I think the other side of that coin is that there are opportunities that exist in there, and that's what I want to focus on now. So, and let's get into maybe some of the more promising models that your work has uncovered. So here's another quote from you I really like. The quote is, "If you took $1,000 and invested it in a certificate of deposit in any of the three largest banks in America today, you would earn 1% or less on your money and have to pay income tax on that gain. Take the same $1,000 and put it in a secure government-issued bond mutual fund, and your rate of return might get as high as 2% in today's market. But if you invested in your own community, you could earn an after-tax rate of return of between 5 and 7%, three times as much. I understand there's an example involving John Deere you've discovered that illustrates this."
John Deere, as you know, was a farm implement manufacturer, is.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of their farmers in the Midwest, in the breadbasket of America, were approached by windmill vendors and said, John Deere used to not only sell tractors and hay balers, they would finance them. They had a whole separate financing company within their corporation structure. And the farmers were approached by windmill manufacturers who wanted to lease land from the farmers, and they told the farmers, look, we'll put the windmill up and you can continue to plant corn around the bottom. You won't lose that much productive land. And the farmers said, well, tell me about how much money you're going to make off the windmill. And, you know, the farmers aren't stupid. And when they learned the rate of return on some of these windmill projects, they went to John Deere and said, hey, I'll put the windmill up on my own land. Would you finance it? And so we had this situation where renewable energy started to come into being because there was a financing organization with a known trusted customer base that would make unusual loans. And so John Deere figured out a way that they could make money by serving their customer base, and the farmers could make money as well. And it involved taking advantage of tax credits and so forth. If you move to the government sector, right now, about 40% of every dollar that moves through our gross domestic product is a taxpayer dollar. Do you know that? About 40%. So that owns, in the building stock of the United States, one-third of all square footage in the United States is taxpayer-owned. And yet the system that the United States chose to use, the technique they chose to use to foster energy conservation and renewable energy, involved the tax code. So by involving the tax code, what that meant is one-third of all of the potential users of renewable energy and energy conservation were denied access to the incentives. We designed an incentive system that only worked for the for-profit sector as a nation. And so what's happened recently, based on the John Deere model, is LLCs are now forming, and they say, we will put solar energy or wind energy or geothermal or energy conservation into taxpayer-owned buildings. We'll take the tax credits. We'll take the accelerated depreciation. We'll make use of everything that the local power company has been able to do for years and years and years, and we'll split the savings with the taxpayer institution. So the taxpayer institution, who frequently has to participate financially somehow, usually out of their energy savings, the taxpayer institution gets a huge increase in efficiency, and the private sector is incentivized to tap into this 40% of our infrastructure where there's been almost nothing done.
And so these are all retrofits, I assume, to existing buildings,
systems. This particular model that I'm talking about doesn't have to be a retrofit. If you were building a new building and you wanted to put solar, supposing you were building a new school,
yeah,
and you wanted to put solar on the roof,
Yep.
And you had money to buy the school, but you went to this local LLC and said, look, would you guys put solar system on our roof? You get the tax credits, you get the depreciation, and at the end of a certain period of time, you give it to us and you get the tax deduction for the charitable contribution. And you will come out further ahead than if you had put your money in the bank or in a T-bill.
And this is happening? How frequent is this and where is this happening?
It's emerging rapidly. It's one of these, you know, what I try and do is find success stories and talk about them so that people can replicate them. And there have been, there's a firm in California whose name I should have looked up before we talked, and I apologize. But there are several models out there that can be used.
Well, I imagine
they all owe their mental birthright to the John Deere episode.
Interesting. Well, in today's yield-starved environment, anything that sounds like a more than a few percent. I mean, good grief. As of today, junk bonds are yielding in aggregate 5.2%, and those are highly risky investments. So what kind of returns are you seeing in these examples that we're talking about here?
Somewhere in the 6, 7, 8% range, but it depends on where you're located. But if you would, put on a slightly different hat.
Okay.
You're in a community. You've got your choice to invest in junk bond or some other aggregated investment vehicle run by Wall Street or, you know, any of the big names in the financial industry. Or you can go to your buddy at the local school board and say, hey, I was thinking of endowing a scholarship in honor of my daughter or something. Instead, I'd like to make you a deal where I'll put solar cells on the roof. And at the end of the period of time, I'll give it to you. And the school board person is likely to say, well, that's a wonderful offer. Why don't you just give us the money now? And the answer is, if he does it through this LLC model, he makes a rate of return that exceeds what he would have made if he invested in the stock market.
Mm-hmm.
So he does good and he does well.
Does good and he does well. All right. Well, let me talk about that doing good and doing well for a second. Because, all right, we have a local high school. They're rebuilding it. And so what they're doing is, I think what probably every municipality does, they're trying to save money, you know, keep the costs as low as possible. And they want to optimize and maximize their space. What are they probably missing in that story?
Operating costs. Typically, the people who build a building don't pay for its operating costs. In a school, the single highest expense line item in a budget is salary. The second largest line item is typically energy.
Mm.
Now, that includes energy for the school buses and energy for air conditioning and so on and so forth. Second largest line item in a school system is energy cost. But when the bond issue comes up to build the local school, what they want to do is build the biggest
yep.
building they can for the cheapest amount of money they can. So they skimp on the insulation, they buy cheap windows, they don't use advanced air conditioning system, they use cheap lighting fixtures, and so they cut the ribbon on something which looks glorious, but when it comes time to pay the energy bill, it's a great deal higher than it needs to be. And there have been all kinds of studies done, one here in Statesville, North Carolina, well, in Massachusetts, they went back and looked at the construction costs of school buildings and found out that by spending an additional 2.5% on the front end of building a building, they earned 100% rate of return on that 2.5% every year for the life of the building.
Wow, 100% rate of return. And that's in direct energy savings, right?
In direct energy savings.
So that means less oil burned, less coal burned, less carbon in the atmosphere.
Right. Setting aside all of the externalized environmental costs, just as a business dish, this is where I say we can talk to the right wing and the left wing at the same time. If you go to the school board member and say, look, I can guarantee you 100% rate of return on taxpayer money by being a fiscal conservative, he'll listen. If you go to the other side of the aisle and say, look, we want to spend a little bit more building this thing, we're going to remove air pollution and so on and so forth, they'll listen. And here's the kicker. One of the ways you get this 100% rate of return on the investment is you spend a part of that 2.5% by increasing the use of daylight in the school. And when you do that, and this has been fully documented, student learning rates go up between 12 and 17%.
A little daylight on the situation, huh?
That's right. We're shining a light on it.
Huh.
So the mission of the school is to educate students. You help them do that. The mission of the school board member is to try and provide an adequate building at a reasonable cost. We've done that. And we've cleaned up the environment at the same time.
So that's a win-win-win. And what I found, I was talking with another gentleman recently who was relating an experience where his church was building out a $2.5 million redo of their church. And he looked at the plans, and this guy's an energy expert in the heating systems, cooling systems in particular. And he took one look at the design and said, oh my gosh, this is going to, we're going to use a system that's absolutely going to kill us. Spreadsheeted the whole thing out, went back to the church board and said, look, if we just put this system in instead of that one, we're going to actually save more than the building cost over the life of it. And they were surprised, right? Because they'd hired a very good architecture firm. And it wasn't that this was a bad architecture firm. It's that this understanding of how to optimize around energy costs is just not well embedded yet in our culture for some reason, I guess. And
well, there's a wrinkle to that, which is I suspect when they let the bid documents,
mm-hmm.
they did not specify an operating cost per square foot. So no target was established. So they went to bid and they said, we want to build a church of 150,000 square feet or something, and it has to be Gothic and it's got to have so many square feet of stained glass or, you know, whatever it is that they specified.
Mm-hmm.
But I'll bet that when they got to energy, they simply said it must be code compliant. And codes are obsolete. Codes are 30 years behind. So if they said, you have to be able to operate this for $1.25 per square foot per year, they would have got a different building.
Having the right measures in place. Is that the right measure to use?
It's one of several.
One of several.
Yes.
All right. So this all sounds really fascinating for somebody who's got quite a bit of capital or can form an LLC or has the time to put into that. What kind of stories do you have for people who are looking to maybe divert $10,000 not to Wall Street but to their local community? What kinds of things could they do?
Well, one of the forms that these LLCs take is that you get a principal investor who's what's called a qualified investor. Your readership and listenership likely knows what that means.
Yep.
And in addition, they can take on secondary partners in the LLC. And so these become community investors. And they market the LLC as a form of invest in your local economy and earn a bigger rate of return than you would if you shipped your money off to Wall Street. And you can keep an eye on your investment. Just drive down the road and look at it.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a much higher level of security and a much higher level of community pride and the development of social networks and so on and so forth, which have all kinds of secondary social benefits.
Now, you have a book out. It's called How America is Getting It Right, Proven Local Solutions to National Problems. This, the identity of these LLCs or how to form them, I assume, are examples in the book?
I did not name specific. I think I named two, as I recall. But if it's of interest, I'll put some up on my website, and people can go there, and I'll route them. I'll offer half a dozen different places people could contact.
That would be great, because even if to find the models to understand how those could be replicated within their local communities, if not to just directly invest in them, because there's a lot of hunger for this out there right now. Obviously, you know, people are distrustful of Wall Street and the stock market, and I believe rightly so. They're distrustful of big banks who never seem to lose, and they want to have more direct control over their investments. They want it to be tangible. They would like the returns to be there. They would like to have the returns accrue to both their communities as well as to themselves for dedicating their capital. All of these things seem eminently doable. What we're really lacking are the concrete examples of just exactly how to get that done, because it seems complex.
It is complex, but if you went to Wall Street, they'd be paying significant law firms millions of dollars a year to develop these things. So there are some models out there. The town you live in, I'm willing to bet, has got a fairly significant number of people who invest either and have set up LLCs. Mostly they own real estate. The guy who owns the local shopping center, that kind of investor, already knows how to do an LLC. His accountant already knows how to do accelerated depreciation. His tax attorney knows how to take advantage of federal and state tax credits. This knowledge is available within the community that your readership and listenership occupies. It's not doing new stuff. What it's doing is taking old stuff and applying it to a new market that had been overlooked, which is the 40% of all building square footage in the United States, which is paid for by taxpayers.
This is the part that's fascinating to me because it seems like a no-brainer. It seems like if you can reach across whatever constituency you care to speak to and say, look at how this is a benefit, and it's going to save money at the same time. It's also going to make us more resilient. It's going to deliver us possibly a higher quality of life as well, as the example of having natural daylight in there obviously provides a quality enhancement to the experience as measured through educational returns. So all of these things seem like things that are just no-brainers. And yet, it turns out they are brainers, to flip that term around, because they aren't done all that often. Now, there's an interesting psychological exploration to discuss why these things don't happen, and there's this opportunity set on the other side. How much room do you think there is to run on the side of delivering these positive solutions into places that need them?
I think there's a great deal. And here's what I believe has happened over the last several decades. When I was a boy, the guy who ran the local bank knew my father personally. My dad was a fireman. My dad knew the local banker. There was a relationship there where my father knew who to tap into for local expertise. And when we got into the consolidation of local banks into regional banks and national banks, and the presidents of those banks no longer were rooted in the community, but they transferred every 3 years to a different part of the corporation, the expertise still exists at that local bank, but the relationship doesn't. So what I have found, as I've talked about this with a number of different people, is there are a great number of community banks, and when I go in and I lay it out for them, they get very thoughtful, and they'll say, well, I imagine I can find several lead investors for you. In fact, I know exactly who I'll call. But what we have not seen, I think, is that the younger activist group, by and large, doesn't live in the world of finance and would say, I think I'll go down to the local bank, not Bank of America or one of the big ones, because they're going to get shunted into a different kind of investment. But the local bank is going to say, well, I'm the guy who made the loan to the shopping center or the movie theater real estate investor, and I think he'd be interested in this. And not only that, I'll bet he'd want to do it at his own shopping center. He just doesn't even know it.
All right. Well, let me turn now to, in the time we have left, I'm interested, you have a whole chunk on food security and what can be done on the food production side, because I do know a lot of the younger people who have gravitated to that side because they've got health and vigor and the interest and the passion to be on the food production side. And a lot of them are actively seeking new models. And of course, there are some relatively well-established models, the CSA model, community-supported agriculture. We've got some directive farm-to-retail markets that are starting to pop up. Of course, farmers markets. What else have you found on the food side? I know you've got some pretty interesting stories in your book there. Which one sort of pops out at you as one you'd like to relate here?
Well, there are several. Let me tell a essentially for-profit model and then a not-for-profit model. Mm-hmm. One is what amounts to an eBay for harvest. In this particular model, some central authority, a farmer's co-op or somebody, gets access to a piece of software and goes to the local people who buy food, restaurants and institutions, and said, in October, if we could ship you bushels of corn, what day would you want it and how much would you want? And what would you be willing to pay for it? And so a market is created. There's a potential seller that goes up on the eBay for food. And then members of the co-op who produce food say, I'll sign on to produce that many bushels of corn for that fellow, for that customer. And a deal is struck using the computerized farm to market, if you will, system as a middleman, as a disintermediary. So people don't have to sell their whole crop to Cisco, and then Cisco sells it to the local institution.
Mm-hmm.
And that has had quite a dramatic impact in niche food markets where restaurants want to offer unusual things like 2-foot-long string beans or special-sized mushrooms or heirloom tomatoes. If the restaurant's brand is rooted in, no pun intended there, rooted in unique foods, they can solicit farmers who want to grow unique foods and pay a premium price for it. The other one that I think is particularly interesting in the not-for-profit sector is where you use a computer system and you go to everybody who says they're willing to grow food for a soup kitchen or some charitable, an orphanage or something. And instead of just letting them plant whatever they want to plant and take responsibility to get 5 tomatoes and a couple of string beans and some squash on an irregular basis to the recipient who looks at it and says, gosh, we weren't planning on using squash today, but if we don't, it'll go bad. This computer system says the orphanage would like this many bushels of something this day. We suggest you plant these seeds which have this kind of ripening time so that you'll be ready. And essentially a contract is written between the grower and the customer, even though in this case the customer is not paying. It's a donation. But it's scheduled. And what it does is vastly reduce the infrastructure of freezing, delivering, storage, and so on and so forth, because it's time to be market ready at the time the customer is expecting it.
So there you have a profit and a nonprofit example. I see in your book you've got examples around shortening the food supply chain, of which that sounds like a portion of that, although your story in the book is a different one, and that there is still hunger amidst plenty is one of your chapters, helping small farmers in aquaculture, a story about a place in Albany, Indiana, that's producing 2 million pounds annually, and so on. So there's different sections in your book here that cover fighting obesity, environmental contamination, climate change, reducing building energy water use, some of those examples we talked about. And all of these are real live examples that are operating today and seem to be working. Is that right?
Yes. Each of my articles describes a national problem, documents it academically, talks about the future implications of how it's going to get worse or who it's going to hurt, and then says, here's a community that has figured this out. You can go to XYZ city in Indiana and look what they did, and here's their response, here's their results. And every chapter in the book, and there's 65 different articles, has about 1.5 successful examples. So there's over 100 successful examples of how local communities are reinventing America, making money while they're doing it, and cleaning up the environment while they're doing it.
Well, that is just a fantastic story. And we're just about the end of our time here. I just want to remind people again that you can go to the website, which is theoptimisticfuturist.com. You can get the book, How America is Getting It Right. Francis, where do people find that book?
It's on Amazon and it's on ebooks platform.
Well, there you go. And thank you so much for being with us. The summary is that there are lots of things that we can and should be doing today that will save us money, deliver excellent returns, slow down the consumption of fuels, maybe deliver a higher quality of life, heck, maybe even help save the world. So I love those stories. Francis, thank you so much for doing that work and for being on the program.
Well, thank you. I look forward to doing it again. I appreciate the chance to spread the word.
Well, I'm looking forward to part two of this book, which will have another 100 examples, because this is what's happening right now. It's a movement, and it's exciting to see it documented and conveyed, because people just need to know about it. It's great work. Thank you so much.
Thank you.